Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:08 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is March 22nd, and it's Fed Day. So we just had the press conference from Jay Powell, and what he had to say was pretty simple, that they want to try and get inflation down to 2%. And there's a lot of uncertainty that has suddenly appeared in the regional banking sector. That uncertainty is also equivalent to monetary tightening. So they raised rates by 25 basis points, and the bond market is now very much of the opinion that they're going to be cutting rates by the end of the year. And the really, I guess the question then is, are they going to raise rates one more time? Or are they going to rely on quantitative tightening? Because that was the other thing they announced today, that the pace of quantitative tightening is not stopping. So the infusion of liquidity that boosted the size of the Fed's balance sheet last week, which was technically not quantitative easing, and is probably going to now begin to be reversed in the next month as they persist with their quantitative tightening program. And I think it's interesting right now that the 2-year yield, which has quite clear type 2 top formation characteristics, so we have the loss of momentum, the failed upside break, the massive reaction against the prevailing trend, the break in the succession of higher reaction lows, then a really quite exceptionally large downside weekly key reversal, and then even more follow through the week after. So there's a lot to say here, or to support the view that the peak is in for the 2-year yield. Now let's just simply look at, because that's a very volatile week that we're looking at so far with tail on both the top and bottom of the candle. So let's zoom in. And what we're then going to see here is that the yield is starting to come back down. It steadied for 2 days, and then in the aftermath of the Fed meeting, it's starting to come back down again. So the bond market is pricing in the real potential that we're going to see interest rate cuts before very long, and it really is then only a matter of time. So when we then think about what's likely here, well, I think it's most particularly interesting or noteworthy that the regional banking sector has not rebounded. And that is despite the fact that the FDIC and the Fed and the Treasury got together last weekend and backstopped all deposits. The regional banks have not rebounded. And the proximate cause of that, of course, is that they're still holding losses from their bond portfolios. And any bank that has had any kind of longer duration exposure in their portfolio is sitting on a significant loss. And this is true of the banking sector internationally. So when we think about the global banking sector, then Japanese and European banks were buying all those negative yielding bonds, and the global bank index has pulled back exceptionally sharply from the peak that we saw at the beginning of the year. It's now right in the middle of the range, but we need to zoom out to see the full magnitude of how long it's been ranging for and how depressed those levels are relative to where the peaks were back in 2006. So this move from negative yields to positive yields is having a knock-on effect for lots of banks. But then it's also noteworthy that even though the risk is concentrated in the regional banks, the large banks have also failed to rally. And as of today, and the failure to hold the rebound earlier this week, this index is right back on its lows. So there is obviously the potential here that the tightening credit standards are going to feed through into the economy at some stage. And Jay Powell has been quite clear and continues to reiterate that they want to get the inflation rate back down to 2%. Well, I think it is worth just looking at the chart of the PCE, because what it helps to highlight is that on aggregate, the level is lower than the CPI. It's still at about 4.7%, but it hasn't come down a lot from where the peak was at the beginning of 2022. So still running way higher than it did prior to the pandemic. And it's also, I think, noteworthy to highlight that from approximately 1995 onwards, it pops on the upside for inflation. Above 2% were not sustained. And since then, we've had this really profound breakout. I think there are three factors that have contributed to the inflation. So the first is massive money printing. And the size of the Fed's balance sheet is just an easy way of looking at that. And we had this huge move on the upside in response to the pandemic. Now they're in a process of quantitative tightening. Now, obviously, the size of the Fed's balance sheet went up last week in response to the banking crisis, and this is probably just the beginning. But they're going to persist with quantitative tightening for another couple of months, but the chances are that the lows are in. So that was the first thing that contributed to inflation was money printing. Then, of course, the second is that lots of people used the pandemic as an excuse to retire. So there are fewer workers. But then there was a boost in demand for workers because of all that money printing. So there was a huge mismatch between available workers and available jobs. Then, so that's the second reason for inflation. Now, if we think about what the solutions are, well, if the size of the if the money printing was the problem that caused inflation, then deflation is likely a result of quantitative tightening. If the availability of workers is a problem, then the economy has to shrink back to a size commensurate with the number of available workers, and that's where the recession risk resides. So that could also help to contain inflation. But then, of course, we have energy. And energy prices accelerated higher in the immediate aftermath of the pandemic. Now, the oil price broke downwards earlier this week and has steadied over the last couple of days, and it is unwinding the short-term oversold condition and pushing back up to test the region of the overhead trading range. But this, I think, also helps to highlight that $80 isn't especially expensive compared to where the peak values are, but the speed with which the price went up between 2020 and 22 is remarkable. But I think this also helps to broach the subject of the cost of doing business and regulatory constraints, because the efforts at decarbonization, whether it is at Europe's efforts at decarbonization and the Green Agenda, or the Inflation Reduction Act in the USA, or China's efforts to curtail coal, all of those factors replace a highly efficient way of generating electricity with a less efficient way. And the intermittency issue, which then contributes to capacity constraints, are renewable energy like wind and solar unable to meet their headline capacity production because they don't work when the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing. So it means that we're basically substituting efficiency for inefficiency. And of course, that same efficiency for inefficiency plays through into this argument about globalization and reshoring. Now, I don't think that this is something that's going to happen immediately, and obviously the trend of travel is towards differentiation away from China. The primary service, what they call in China the One Dragon service, is that everything is available to you in one place. Well, if manufacturing components are made in different locations, then that's it might be reasonably efficient, but it's not as efficient. That's going to increase costs. And of course, that's inflationary. So when we think then about efficiency gains, well, if we don't have clear evidence of efficiency gains, then that's also going to contribute to inflation. And of course, I really do think that politicians aren't really serious about decarbonization. That a lot of the regulations that have been put in place are really more about raising revenue. So the uranium ETF is right in the region of its lows around the 1,000-day moving average, and it was and it is still easing back. So we're not seeing a groundswell of support for uranium. Then we think about the solar sector. Well, it has held up over the course of the last couple of months, but it is very interest rate sensitive, and it's at least firming from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Now, when we think about where the outlook is likely for inflation, well, I think that if we are at the peak of the interest rate cycle and the Fed is about to rely on credit tightening to do its job rather than interest rate hikes, that is beneficial for gold. And the price was rebounding today up nearly $30. So this is just looking like a mild consolidation in the region of the 2000 level. Silver prices continue to recover as well. And the price is more depressed than gold was, so it does have further to go on the upside, and this rebound remains on pace. What I'm interested in at the moment as well is the rebound that's beginning to take place in palladium. And the reason that palladium had rallied so spectacularly in the first place was because there was a reticence to invest in retooling to avoid using palladium. So, and that of course was the reason behind that was that the automotive companies don't anticipate having to manufacture catalytic converters for very much longer. But then the price has steadied up in here today, and it was up $60. So this the potential here is that the weakness of the dollar will help to support both precious and industrial resources. So palladium today is looking like at least an upside day, if not an upside key reversal, because it's not at an actual new low, but certainly an upside outside day. And then platinum prices have been rather moribund for most of the last few years, and continuing to hold out around this $1,000 level. And it really does need to sustain a move up through that in order to really demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. If the USA is now at the peak or close to the peak of the interest rate hiking cycle, that is dollar bearish, and the dollar is pulling back. It's cyclically way overdue weakness. And generally, it has bull and bear trends that last about 7 years. So the bull trend was extended because of the pandemic. But now it does look like it's ending. And that does suggest that there's going to be additional upside pressure on some of these industrial resources, that the weaker dollar will support commodity prices generally. That will also help to support the outlook for the big bull market in industrial resources fueled by the decarbonization movement. Now, this, I think, is a very difficult thing to rationalize, whereas the argument for decarbonization is largely illogical, that there simply aren't enough resources to achieve the goal. It's not going to stop politicians from trying. And that is where the foundation of the bull market rests, that there'll be a clear effort to try and decarbonize. And then it's going to lead to significantly higher metal prices, which will make the economics of trying to decarbonize completely untenable. And that's probably going to then represent the end of the cycle. But I suspect that prices have to go up first, then down later. And then that's likely to continue to contribute to cyclicality in the mining sector. So the BlackRock World Mining Trust has certainly weakened over the last couple of or the last month, but it is continuing to hold the sequence of higher reaction lows. And there is the potential here that as the dollar weakens, it will create demand for the industrial resources. And the fund is right region of the upper side of this range that's been forming now for 15 years. I think it's relevant too that the Nasdaq, having rallied by about 1% in early trading and right ahead of the press conference, has now reversed and is looking like a downside key day reversal. Now, downside follow through tomorrow would confirm near-term resistance around the 13,000 level, and at least an unwinding of the short-term overbought condition. And I suspect that it's also going to then begin to factor in a reassessment of the immediate bullishness for the AI sector. So, Nvidia, having rallied really exceptionally impressively from the lows in early January, was well off its highs. And I think it's quite likely that we're going to get a good process of consolidation here. The relative strength, though, that artificial intelligence stocks have exhibited in the short term, that is likely an indicator of where we can anticipate the focus of attention will be in a broader recovery following a recession. And leaders tend to lead in both directions, but then they also lead for a reason. And artificial intelligence has the potential to at least provide some kind of productivity growth. But that doesn't mean that it has to happen this side of a recession. And I suspect that we will have better buying opportunities as the yield curve moves from inversion to a positive slope. And that's usually when the biggest selling pressure occurs. Then it's likely that some of these companies will exhibit relative strength. And at that point, they would be, I think, viable longer-term investment candidates. And if when we think about Google, for example, it popped up in early trading today and then unwound most of the advance. So I do think that there is clearly the scope here for additional pause and consolidation. And this weakness in the banking sector is not something that we can simply ignore for the simple reason that banks are liquidity providers. And bull markets thrive on liquidity. So when liquidity providers are struggling, it tells us that liquidity is short to come by or hard to come by, and then that has a knock-on effect for just about everything else. I think it's inevitable then that employment is going to become problematic. That will then force the Federal Reserve to start cutting rates. There'll be a surprise in terms of a deflationary shock, and we'll start to see interest rates coming back down. We'll see valuations improve considerably. That will then create a buying opportunity. Because we have a lower peak in the yield curve, spread, I suspect that what we're going to now see are shorter, sharper cycles, where we'll have really impressive bull trends that will last for a year to 18 months at a time, and then subsequently we'll have tightening cycles, because the task of trying to curtail inflation is exceptionally difficult, and it's going to be very difficult to pursue that when unemployment starts rising. So if they get any kind of evidence at all that inflationary pressures are moderating, I would anticipate that interest rates will start to come back down. And that likely to put downward pressure on the dollar, because of the volume of cash that will be created in order to deal with a deflationary shock. And the fact that gold is breaking on the upside is certainly an indication of where interest is starting to move. And then also the fact that Bitcoin is rallying towards the 30,000 level, but then is behaving more like a tech stock than a hard asset. Now, I think the bull case for Bitcoin is not so much that it is an analog for gold, but rather that it is a liquidity barometer. And when liquidity starts to improve, then I anticipate that Bitcoin will sustain a clear breakout. But as the Nasdaq pulls back, then Bitcoin is unlikely to be immune to that. In this regard, gold is probably a better hedge against financial sector tightness and the potential for currency debasement, whereas Bitcoin is more of a play on liquidity provision. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.